This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Everybody get ready for Foodie and the Beast with David and Nikki Nellis. A foodie born and bred, my wife Nikki loves chatting up chefs, dining out, and insider industry buzz.
And my husband David thinks a great meal is nothing but a good burger, a frosty brew, and a check for under $20. Because he is cheap.
Well, maybe so, but Foodie married Beast anyway, and together we've got the food and wine variety show that has everyone talking.
It's Foodie and the Beast, and we are on now.
Hey, everybody, welcome to Foodie and the Beast with David and Nikki Nellis on a beautiful Sunday morning. It's gorgeous out there.
It's a pool day.
We've got an amazing show, a show that's going to make you think, and it's going to make you drink. And speaking of drinking, the Rammies are next Sunday, June 7th. That's the Oscars for the local restaurant industry and everybody that works for it.
The Grammys for the local industry.
You know what?
Get it? Grammys, Rammies.
No.
I am doing this.
Clyde's managing director, Dave Moran, has the honor of being the Rammies Gala Chair, and he's brought us all the Rammy finalists for the Regional Food and Beverage Producers Award. And there ain't no food, it's all beverages. And they bought some awesome taste of their nominated potables.
And I will say, for the record, everybody has been in here before, right? So anybody?
Yeah.
Well, you haven't been
Jonathan
here before,
hasn't.
But Early Mountain Vineyard has
Early
been here
Early Mountain
before.
Vineyards, Jonathan Hollerith is a winemaker, and you manage the production facility as well, right?
Yes, I'm making the wine, and I'm also growing the grapes.
Well, we're going to be tasting. We're going to find out what's going on with that.
We've been down there. It's
Scott
so
Harris from Catoctin Creek, when we first met him, he was so excited to be the first distiller in Loudoun County since before Prohibition, and now he's selling in Europe and Asia, and I think you've got distribution on Mars, too, which is awesome.
Yeah, we hope so.
Mari Rodell is in from D.C. Brow, the famous D.C. Brewers.
Mm-hmm. Good morning.
And John Uselton from Green Hat. Now, I guess we had you in here. We had you in here first off when you guys had just gotten started. Now you're everywhere too, right?
We were but a young, small little distillery over in Northeast.
Now you're hot stuff.
Maybe this says something about us. Can somebody say something about Foodie and the Beast?
It is. It's
maybe
basically you come on the show
and then you
blow up. Exactly.
I'm sure,
yeah.
I'm sure Gene Bauer's all excited.
I know. Keep going. Okay. Well, you might have seen Gene Bauer recently on the Jon Stewart Show, and if you didn't, you should Google it and watch it because it's an amazing interview. But Gene is an animal activist. He is the co-founder and president of really what's considered the largest refuge for farm animals in the world, the Farm Sanctuary. And he has put together a fabulous book that is really a little bit of a memoir, a ton of fabulous recipes, and really a lifestyle guide for those of you who are even considering going vegan. And it's called Living the Farm Sanctuary Life. It is an absolute must read, and I'm really looking forward to talking to Gene later on in the show. And more authors on the show. Later in the show, we are going to be talking to book author Steve Yaffa, who has written Grain of Truth. And I think we hear a lot about people talking about gluten. I can't eat gluten. I'm gluten-free, celiac.
Seth Rogen says gluten is everything.
Gluten's in everything. You watch This Is the End? Nobody has watched This Is the End. Okay, that failed.
I listened to all the famous philosophers, Seth Rogen, somebody else.
Anyway, but we're really going to get the truth about gluten, and it's really not as terrible as you all think. So we'll talk to Steve later on in the show about that.
But let's start with Dave Moran and the Rammies.
Okay.
Dave, give us the Rammies 411. Why do it? What is it? What happens?
Well, it's a celebration of the best and the brightest in the industry. Mm-hmm. We're expecting about 2,000 people next Sunday night down at the D.C. Convention Center. It's the best party of the year, and it's mm-hmm. grown as the industry's grown. It started off as a dinner, a multi-course dinner over 33 years ago, where people were honored, and it's grown to a point where it is now a banging party.
It is a total banging party.
We started off, we converted a couple
Amazing
years.
Amazing how words work their way into the lexicon that have actually no connection with what we're talking about. But yes, a banging party.
We actually changed it from a couple years back from a sit-down dinner to an award-style banquet now, where we start off with a great cocktail hour featuring some of these producers in the room with us. Mm-hmm. We then do a nice hour-long award ceremony, very similar to the Grammys or Oscars or whatever mm-hmm. which we wanted to use. And then it goes into a real fun cocktail party where is what we all really want to do is hang out with each other, celebrate those who have won these prestigious awards, and have a blast.
Give CPR to all your friends.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the awards, because every year you sort of change the focus of the awards. I mean, there was always like the best new restaurant and, you know,
best chef.
Sure. And, right, exactly. But every year, as the industry changes, you add new awards. Can we talk about some of the new ones this year?
Sure. Well, I think the one that's probably the newest and we're here to talk about is the regional producers and suppliers. And I think that's also what's exploded in this area, not just the restaurant scene, but you've got these great products and suppliers who are now bringing these things to the table that we're all using in our restaurants. People want to eat and drink local, and not just by going to the restaurant, but they want to enjoy the products of that's coming from here. Mm-hmm. And that's an example.
Well, don't you think that has to do also, I mean, first of all, the chefs really wanted local, which created the producers. And now, you know, now the laws have changed so much that that can really happen.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, with the beers and distilleries, it was really tough to make that happen. And now there's just this amazing crop of new products out there.
Yeah, and a segmentation of the industry, because there's now, we have best casual brunch. And,
right.
Because the whole move towards the casual experience is...
I'm sorry, we had that yesterday morning at our house, and it was awesome.
It was really casual.
You should be nominated.
I said, did you get a Rammy?
Well, actually, I was near naked. It was very casual. Casual and disgusting.
Right. This is a little too much information for everybody here at the table. Anyway, well, so let's talk about some of the other big awards for this year that are a little different than the years past, other than the current one.
Let's see, we said best chef, best restaurant.
Right.
One of the bigger ones is the best new chef and new restaurant.
Right.
And that's sort of where there's a lot of focus as well. You know, a lot of the people are very aware of the restaurants that have been around the scene for a while.
Mm-hmm.
But the exciting ones are the newcomers. And that's why I think people want to meet who's new in the industry. What's happening?
Mm-hmm.
It's funny because, you know, a lot of the older restaurants, you know, it's a black tie event. And then sure enough, there's the new chef or the new mixologist who shows up in their kilt.
Right.
And sort of blows the party up. And they're usually ones that have the best speeches as
Wait
well.
Wait till you see my black tie Speedo. That is going to be awesome. All right. Well, why don't we talk to one of the nominees?
All right. Let's get into Early Mountain Vineyard.
All right. So Jonathan Hollerith from Early Mountain Vineyard, Steve and Gene Case's Vineyard down in Madison, Virginia. We've done a couple of live remotes from down there.
We have.
Stunning facility. You know, that lawn out front, however many acres that is, if you lie down, you can't see one blade of grass that's above any of the others. It's that perfect.
Right.
It looks like
it's
a putting
pristine.
Green.
It's beautiful.
And the
very
wines
beautiful.
Are great.
It's great
so
office to have.
Talk about your wines, and then we want to talk about the program you have to promote Virginia products.
Well, so talking about the wines, we have two of our summer wines. Everybody notices the hot temperatures outside, obviously, so we're showcasing our Rosé and our Pinot Gris 2014. And both these wines are being made in a style to capture the freshness, the acidity, the playfulness, something to drink when it's hot outside and keep your mouth watering.
For the Rosé, for example, we've had a bunch of winemakers in here over the years, and sometimes they prefer drier weather. You know, it depends on where they are and the land and all of that. What is it you're looking for this rosé to produce it?
Well, both these wines are dry. The rosé has, if you can consider residual sugar, it's past the point where it would be considered a off dry, but it has the most residual sugar between the Pinot Gris and the rosé. The rosé.
I know, but it's not heavy on the tongue. I mean.
Yeah.
As a dry rosé, that's why it's so lovely and light.
Well, so that's one of the things that makes this wine special to us.
Mm-hmm.
It was targeted in the vineyard to be picked with the right amount of acidity, low enough sugar so that it doesn't translate into too high of an alcohol. So we could capture the elegance of the vineyard and frame that elegance around that acidity. And then in the fermentation, to finish it off with that real light hint of sweetness in the background. It's still dry, but it also has a little bit of that body
Let's talk about biodynamics, because that's a word that basically it appears in all your literature. What does it mean, and how are you applying it?
Well, it's voodoo, right?
It's voodoo.
Oh, you mean it's BS?
No. Just repeating, it is not.
Actually, it's BD, biodynamics.
Biodynamics. It is, it's a process where you're actually strengthening your vines from within, or if you're a gardener, your plants from within. You're using products like teas, lots of teas. We spray chamomile, dandelion, stinging nettle, horsetail, orange peel extract. So we have a lot of thoughtful approaches in our vineyards.
But isn't there also in biodynamic, like...
Yeah, you work with the moon cycles.
Right, moon cycles, and you do some burying of things and stuff like that.
Well, you're a bunch of hippies, aren't you?
We totally are, in the best possible way. You know, for example, with the moon cycles, you can target your pruning to go with the moon. So when you have a waxing moon, you have sap flow pushing out of the vine.
Mm-hmm.
And if you cut the shoot at that time and then the sap flows out, you're actually pushing out disease or fungal matter that could land on
like
that wound.
It's like letting it bleed.
And instead, if you... prune during a waning moon, the sap is going inwards to the vine.
I'm sorry, it sounds like Wicca to me.
but it works. It does work.
It works. It works. It's been practiced by many for the past 30 plus years in France, in Germany. That's where I started getting into the whole biodynamic and organic programs. I worked very closely with a gentleman at a winery called Reitzrat von Buhl. And he's
That's
been,
easy for you to say.
And it's been, he's been practicing biodynamics for 10 plus years now.
Mm-hmm.
And working closely with him has brought us a lot of advantages.
Also, since Early Mountain Vineyards doesn't just sell their wines, I mean, you guys talk, you curate a lot of other Virginia wine and products. As the winemaker, is that hard for you? Because you're like, no, I just want to do my wines.
No, not at all. I think it's great to be able to come to Early Mountain and be able to taste Virginia, because as a winemaker or as a vigneron, however you want to put that label, the one thing that makes wine so special is terroir expression, meaning, you know, what is the soil giving and what is the way the sun is hitting the vines? What is that doing? And, you know, each site is different, and Virginia has so many different terroir sites. You have, you know, the Eastern Shore. You have the other side of the Shenandoah. You have different soil types. And to be able to capture that at Early Mountain as a consumer, to see that, I think it's great that we offer that.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about your red?
The red wine is a 64% Merlot and 36% Cabernet Franc.
Mm-hmm.
And it is our most approachable and elegant red that we make. The vineyard... It wants to be made in that way. The fruit is, so we have, you know, speaking of terroir, we have some vineyard sites that are better drained and are producing smaller berries, higher concentrated. And this is producing slightly larger berries, a little bit more elegant fruit. And, you know, we're able to capture the elegance of that fruit in this vineyard and through the winemaking.
What year is it?
It's a 2013.
Okay. And was that a good year for Virginia?
It was. You know, that's a, speaking of, you know, weather in Virginia, that's one of the things that makes it great here. You know, you have vintages, such great differences here. So 13, very different from 14, 12, very different from 11, for example. And 13 was a wet year at the beginning. And luckily at the end, during the ripening phase, we got a lot of good weather.
I got we've got 30 seconds till we have to go to a commercial, but are you feeling climate change at all?
You know what? The world is, Virginia is one of the places where that wavelength of change is felt less, but our winters have become a little bit problematic for us, a little
more
bit
severe.
More so, okay. A little bit colder.
All right.
We'll
have you back in 20 years.
Okay.
You can talk to my corpse.
This is David and Nikki Nellis for Foodie and the Beast. We'll be back in just a minute.
They say if you have your health, you have everything. But at Kaiser Permanente, we believe most people are spending too much time managing theirs, waiting on referrals, arguing about who covers what, trying to crisscross networks. It's all time that could be better spent strolling a farmer's market or trying out that new Butts and Guts class. At Kaiser Permanente, care and coverage work together. Everything you need is linked. So our talented doctors work as part of a team whose one shared goal is doing whatever it takes to keep you feeling good. To see how care and coverage together can make your life healthier and easier, take a few minutes and visit kp.org. We promise you it will be time well spent. Kaiser Permanente. Together we thrive.
What happens when you bring care and coverage together? Doctors spend less time on paperwork and more time with patients. top docs doing their thing. Visit kp.org/believe.
Top doctors listed in Baltimore Magazine, November 2013, and Washingtonian Magazine, March 2014. Kaiser Foundation Health Plan of the Mid-Atlantic States Incorporated, 2101 East Jefferson Street, Rockville, Maryland, 20852.
This is Mark Amtower. With lower margins, your limited marketing budget has to work harder than ever. LinkedIn is one of the most robust marketing platforms available. With over 350 million members worldwide, 110 million in the U.S., and 3.1 million members within 50 miles of this station, I guarantee your customers and prospects are here. Connect, influence, motivate, create leads. I can show you how. When you want to maximize the return on your LinkedIn presence, email me at mark@federaldirect.net.
Okay, so five tacos of cheese and a large soda, that's $10,012. Please drive around.
Wait, 10,000 what?
It's obvious you're buzzed and driving.
I've only had a few. I'm fine.
Yeah, the food's $12, but getting pulled over for buzz driving could cost you around $10,000 in fines, legal fees, and increased insurance rates. Please drive around. Actually, just park and come in.
Nothing kills a buzz like getting pulled over for buzz driving, because buzz driving is drunk driving. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Foodie and the Beast with David and Nikki Nellis. I think it's fair to say that a lot of us have the impetus to do something really good, but we don't necessarily find a way to live it out. And Gene Bauer certainly has.
That's the guy who ordered a hot dog and french fries yesterday for lunch.
Right. But I didn't hear the french fries screaming, did you? So Gene is the founder and the driving force behind Farm Sanctuary here in the U.S. He's written a book called Living the Farm Sanctuary Life. He's with us now. He's an animal activist and a protector of all sorts of injured beasts that we all should be. Gene, let's start from the first of all. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
This will be a lot more hardball than John Stewart. I'll tell you that. Talk about Farm Sanctuary. What is it? Why is it? How did it get started?
Well, Farm Sanctuary is an organization that works to change how our society views and treats farm animals. We encourage people just to recognize that cows and pigs and chickens and turkeys are animals that have feelings just like cats and dogs. We have turkeys at the farm, for example, that follow you around. They love human companionship when they're treated kindly. And we just want people to think about the way they eat. And, you know, too often we grow up eating animal foods without recognizing the consequences of those choices, and also without recognizing that we can make a choice not to eat animal foods. And I've been a vegan since 1985. And what was
the impetus of that?
I just didn't want to cause harm. You know, I heard about factory farming. I learned about the environmental harms associated with animal agriculture. And I felt that if I can live well without causing unnecessary harm, why wouldn't I?
Well, let me ask you a question. Because when Native Americans would kill a deer in the woods for food, they would stop and thank the animal for giving its life to them. And now we buy, you know, ribeye, you know, at Whole Foods, even if it's pasture raised, and it's a very anonymous process. We don't have to look that cow in the eye and say, hey, you're going to die, you know, Hobie.
Yeah.
And so is that really what's happened?
I think we've become very disconnected from the source of our food, which I think has allowed the factory farming industry to grow and flourish. And even today, where there is, thankfully, widespread opposition to the cruelty of industrialized animal agriculture, there's a push to produce or to sell products sold as free range. But right. A lot of times those labels actually sound better than they are, and people are still too far removed from the food source, so don't really know exactly how the animals are raised when they say, I don't buy factory farming, I hate it, but I only buy humane. But what is humane is another question.
Well, I think that it is confusing, and we were talking a little bit about this off air. You know, people go to Whole Foods because they figure that's a smarter choice than going to, you know, a different market, and that, you know, their eggs are either cage-free or pasture-raised, but they have 17 different kinds of eggs, you know, and some people don't know the difference between pasture-raised and cage-free, and they think cage-free is just fine when it's really not.
Right, and all of these products are probably not as good as they sound.
Okay.
You know, and at the end of the day, the only way to really know is to actually visit the farm, and that's why getting connected to the food source is so important, why it's great to see so many local producers and local restaurants and food people coming together. You know, but it's also important, I think, to recognize that we do have a choice not to eat animals or to eat fewer animals. And at Farm Sanctuary, we're a vegan organization, but we also speak to people where they are on their own journeys. Mm-hmm. You know, we accept any step in a positive direction. So if somebody says, I'm not going to buy factory farmed foods, we think that's positive. If somebody says, I'm going to eat less meat, we think that's positive. So every step, I think, is a positive step. But it's important to recognize that we can live well without eating animals.
Well, there's also the issue, it's pointed out in the book, that how much energy and negative environmental impact raising animals has.
Well,
and
let's discuss that.
Well, wait a minute.
Bit.
Yeah.
Your book points out that there's 17 billion animals right on the face of the earth today raised for feeding 6 billion human beings.
Yes.
So all that land and all that poo and all that stuff is creating a negative, I mean, it's creating a horrendous carbon footprint. So the real question is, how do you get, I mean, you're not a voice crying in the wilderness anymore. There's sort of these steady steps, but how do you get people to sort of look at that and acknowledge it and go, oh my God.
Well, you know, of the 17 billion raised and slaughtered in the world, 10 billion are raised and slaughtered in the U.S. Mm-hmm. So our country really has a big role to play in creating change. And we've actually started to see the number of animals being slaughtered every year in the U.S. going down for the first time. So that's very positive. I think people...
Do you think that's a raise in people eating less meat?
Yes.
Or... cost? I mean, what do you think it is?
I think people are choosing to eat less meat because they recognize that it's problematic health-wise. Mm-hmm. It's been estimated we could save 70% of our health costs by shifting to a whole foods plant-based diet in this country. So mm-hmm. when somebody has a heart attack, there's a strong incentive to look more closely at the food. Or when somebody has to go on heart medication, or they think they do, because in most cases they don't have to if they change how they eat. Mm-hmm. So I think that's been one of the big reasons people are shifting. But also there's more awareness about the cruelty. There's more awareness about the environmental harms. The United Nations put out a report a couple of years ago talking about how animal agriculture contributes more to climate change than the entire transportation industry. So this is an industry that causes so much harm. And I think people do want to do better. People want to live well. And people, I think, also, though, are creatures of habit and afraid of change. So that is kind of where the challenge is. And so how do we create change? And it's usually through small steps, you know, like a Meatless Mondays campaign, for example, mm-hmm. going meatless one day a week, or doing substitutes. Instead of having meatballs on your spaghetti and meatballs, you could try veggie meatballs. And there's all kinds of meatless meats out there now that you can try.
I know, meatless meats, I have a personal problem with. We have to come up with a new term.
They're probably, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
it's just,
I totally hear you there, yeah.
If I'm not going to eat meat, then all the other products need to not have the word meat in it.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I don't want tofurkey or whatever.
So pretend
it is.
They like, don't.
But, wheat balls instead of meatballs.
I love it.
I mean, I just think it should be called
well,
what it is.
Let me ask, I mean, when you encounter people who are, because it's more inertia than anything else. And then once you've done it for a week or two and you go, you know, and you smell a steak cooking somewhere, it's like, oh my God. So what, I mean, because you have a lot of recipes in the book, and we should talk about that. One of the fears that a vegan lifestyle, you know, implies is nothing's going to taste right, and I'm not going to be able to bite into anything. Yeah. And really, you know,
well,
exercise my incisors.
Yeah, things are starting to shift, though, in terms of the culinary world. There's some incredible vegan restaurants and vegan chefs now coming forward with innovative recipes and innovative products even.
Is Dirt Candy vegan? Dirt Candy is vegan?
Dirt Candy, I believe, is vegan, yeah, up in New York City.
Vegan,
so there's, you know, it's amazing. And there are also restaurants that serve meat that have incredible vegan dishes. Mm-hmm. And chefs are taking this on as a challenge and as an opportunity to be creative. Mm-hmm. And so that, I think, has helped to advance the plant-based movement in a significant way, the artistry of chefs creating plant-based dishes.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I've been a vegan since 1985, and we have come so far. You go to mainstream grocery stores now, and you can find several alternatives to cow's milk. You can find coconut milk and soy
almond milk
and
right?
almond milk. It's mm-hmm. like, and then, of course, you know, with the drought in California, there's almonds have been taking it on the chin unfairly.
Right.
Animal agriculture is a much bigger waster of water in California than almonds.
So do you think that's a marketing ploy?
I think it's assumptions and beliefs. You know, we grow up believing certain things, and we believe, for instance, that meat is necessary for protein, when in fact it is not.
Mm-hmm.
And animal agriculture has been entrenched for a long time in California, has been using a lot of water for a long time, and it's assumed that that's normal and okay.
Mm-hmm.
And almonds are kind of the new kid on the block. So in a sense, they're getting, I think, criticized for that reason. But the bottom line is we can produce a lot more food with a lot fewer resources if we grow plant foods and use those instead of growing animal foods.
And so let's talk about the recipes in the book, because there's really, I mean, I was actually surprised by that when I got the book. I didn't think it would be as recipe heavy, and there are fabulous recipes in here.
Yeah.
Who did you talk to? How'd you put it together?
Gosh, we are so lucky to have so many incredible chefs in the vegan movement. There's Tal Ronan, for example, who's worked with Ellen DeGeneres and mm-hmm. Oprah, and he's got a restaurant out in Los Angeles called Crossroads, Candle 79 in New York City, Veg in Philly. There's mm-hmm. a lot of really amazing restaurants and chefs, and these are folks that have participated in competitions on network television and won them as mm-hmm. vegan chefs. So we have 100 recipes from some of the best chefs across the country. I have one recipe in there. I'm not quite as much of a foodie as I wish I was, but it's my scrambled tofu recipe. And, you know, in the past, what I've done with that scrambled tofu is I've sometimes mixed it with stuffing, like your Thanksgiving stuffing, and you get a nice mixture of kind of the heavy protein tofu with the lighter bread stuffing, and it creates a nice balance. So mm-hmm. I don't have that actually in the book, but my only recipe is the scrambled tofu. Okay.
Well, the book is Living the Farm Sanctuary Life, farmsanctuary.org. Can we find the book there? And
yes,
on Amazon?
Absolutely. It's online on Amazon, and farmsanctuary.org is the organization website where people can go to learn more, can come visit the farm, get to know farm animals.
Oh, that would be a great...
I know.
They all have names.
Yeah.
Well, and we just want to say, this is all about eating mindfully, and nobody's expected to change their life in a single day, but it exactly. does make sense to change something.
Absolutely.
And great. Now that we know you live in the D.C. area, I think we could do a whole show on Farm Sanctuary. That would
yeah,
be awesome.
Love to.
Sounds
be
great.
Great.
Okay,
yeah,
Gene, thanks so much.
Thank you. Okay.
Well, ooh, okay, so
let's have a drink.
Let's talk beer. Let's talk beer. Mari, step up to the microphone there.
Right.
Mari Rodella's with D.C. Brow. You're the marketing director, right?
Nope.
What are you?
Are you? What are you doing here?
I'm the chief community and culture officer.
Oh, you're so, that.
That's, yeah. So
that's what marketing directors used to be.
I do some marketing, but usually what I do is like back of the house stuff.
Right.
But
mm-hmm.
I also do like connections with community partners, and I run our donations program.
Well, that's a lot.
Like
all
that.
Right. Give us the D.C. Brow story.
So my husband, Jeff Hancock, who's the brewmaster of D.C. Brow, mm-hmm. He's been brewing for, I think, around 12 years now. And he met his business partner, our business partner, Brandon Skahl, in, I think it was around 2008, 2009. And they just basically hit it off. They decided they wanted to open this brewery in D.C. And actually, you know, being from the area, there hasn't been a production brewery in D.C. There wasn't one for a very long time.
That was like 4 years ago.
Yeah, that was 4 years ago
right.
when
yeah.
we launched.
And now... You're not just D.C. Brow, you're D.C. Brow all up and down the East Coast.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, we're in Connecticut, Jersey, Pennsylvania, and that's why the guys aren't here today, actually. They're in Philly for Philly Beer Week.
Right.
And we're also in Virginia and Maryland. So.
All right. Well,
and,
so
of course, D.C.
And then you're a nominee for the Regional Food and Beverage Producers
yes,
Award.
Yes, we are. Second year.
Your beers are good. Did you bring some to
I
pour?
I did. I
what
brought
did
our
bring?
New Pilsner. So if...
Listen, if we're not drinking on the show, we're not having a show. That's how that is, pal.
So
Gene Bauer laughed when I said that. If you'll see me asking for drinks all the way through the show, that's where that's at.
So what does it mean to you, as you know, for a company like this? I mean, it was a lot sure. for these guys to start this company. I mean, they've been in since the beginning
yeah.
to sort of be recognized like this by the Rammies.
It means a lot because, you know, we had the support of the community when we opened,
mm-hmm.
but it takes a lot to... really, you know, get your product out there in the community and
right.
have people, because there's a lot of competition from the big guys, you know, there's like large beverage producers that, you know, already in. So it took a lot for us as a local to really get into the market. And so, ooh. 4 years later, I know.
Don't say anything.
So, you know, 4 years later, we've had a lot of support from Clyde's group and mm-hmm. from a lot of other restaurant groups and in the area who've believed in us and have carried us. And so this is a nod from our industry, from the folks who have
made us. I was
going to say,
it's so peer-related. It's
yeah.
really nice. Because
it's wonderful.
Especially since you'll be, you know, top of mind at the gala, you know, 20,000 people, all industry people next week. I mean, it's such a great way for... I can't believe that many wouldn't know you, but those who don't,
right.
you know, to sort of be introduced to you.
Absolutely.
You
and
know?
I feel like that group is family, really.
Right.
The Rammies is family. Everybody... pretty much knows us there, and if they don't, well, they'll get to try our beers because we have a lot. We bring a lot to the Rammies, so we'll be
you
there.
Also, you were also staged right next to the dance floor, which
exactly.
is
good,
exactly.
good placement. All right, we're going to take a quick break. This is David and Nikki Nellis with Foodie and the Beast. We'll be right back.
Every day, I wake up at 5 to give Dad his medicine. Every day, I wake up at 5 to give Dad his medicine. At 6, I make his breakfast. Every day I wake up at 5 to give Dad his medicine. At 6 I make his breakfast. At 7 I shower. Every day I wake up
for those caring for a loved one, we hear you. That's why AARP created a community to help us better care for ourselves and the ones we love. Visit aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Green light. Hey, girl. School zone. I'm getting hungry. Car changing lanes. You want to meet me for pizza? Stop sign. Intersection clear. Yeah, street. Pizza sounds good. Ball in street? Girl in street!
It's hard to concentrate on two things at once, like texting and driving. Stop the text, stop the wrecks. How will you stop texting and driving? Tell us at stoptextstopwrecks.org. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
This is Mark Amtower. With lower margins, your limited marketing budget has to work harder than ever. LinkedIn is one of the most robust marketing platforms available. With over 350 million members worldwide, 110 million in the U.S., and 3.1 million members within 50 miles of this station, I guarantee your customers and prospects are here. Connect, influence, motivate, create leads. I can show you how. When you want to maximize the return on your LinkedIn presence, email me at mark@federaldirect.net.
The traditional light bulb, a groundbreaking invention in 1879. It's time we switch to longer-lasting Energy Star light bulbs. They're more efficient than the old bulbs, like a text message is more efficient than a carrier pigeon. And they cut down on our energy costs. Because in our own groundbreaking age, we deserve a light bulb that saves us some cash. Saving energy saves you money. Learn more at energysavers.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Energy and the Ad Council.
All right, we're back on Foodie and the Beast with David and Nikki Nellis, and that whole conversation with Gene Bauer got us on the road. We were talking vegan diets and all of that, which is a great segue into a discussion about something that increasingly is popping up in conversations all over the place, and that's gluten and gluten intolerance. Stephen Yaffa is a man with a lot going on. He's a novelist, he's a journalist, a playwright, and an award-winning screenwriter. But one day his wife told him she'd been diagnosed with gluten neck. And I think he probably said, what is that? It was an Ayurvedic doctor, I think. And he turned his attention to the whole wheat gluten issue, and because gluten is seen by some as a major health hazard equivalent to asbestos. So he did some digging, and he wrote a book. Stephen, are you there?
I am here.
Hi, welcome. It's Grain of Truth. And I know you know my sister Barbie, and you survived that relationship, and I want to congratulate you. I did, too.
I'm just barely surviving it.
Yeah, my wife has a gun in her mouth all the time. But so tell me, what is gluten neck? What is that?
Gluten neck is it turned out to be something of a fantasy, but I didn't know it at the time. I thought it was for real, and so did my wife. She and I have no interest in food fads. In fact, we run the other way if somebody shows up at a cocktail party and starts preaching to us about the latest fad that they're on. So when she came back from this health retreat with some friends and announced that the body worker told her she had a gluten neck, I thought she was joking. I waited for the punchline, but there wasn't any. And the upshot was that they told her her neck was so inflamed that they couldn't work on her, the body workers. And so she decided that she, too, was going to go on a gluten-free diet. And the next thing I knew, I was losing all of my most cherished foods from the crackers and stuff from the pantry. The cupboards, and they were, in their place were coming these squatters, these pretenders that had tapioca flour in them.
Cardboard shaped like crackers?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And I thought, whoa, something's going on here. So I wrote my quick email to my editor in New York, Wendy Wolf at Viking, and she wrote me back immediately and said, this isn't the stupidest idea I've heard all week. And that's kind of New York editor language for I'm interested in. Mm-hmm. And so I wrote a proposal, and about a month later, I got a contract to write a book, which I then went out and had to figure out, what was going to go on, because I really came from the point of view of knowing nothing about the subject. But I'll tell you, as an investigative journalist, one of the great privileges is to be able to snoop and find out about things you know nothing about and supposedly become one of the world's greatest authorities in a matter of weeks or months. But in my case, I was just interested in really whether or not the science that went into this in terms of people you could really trust had anything to do with the fad, which was growing way out of proportion, as it turns out, to the actual situation.
Well, I think one of the reasons why this is so interesting is everybody's talking about gluten, and so many people are saying they are gluten intolerant. and that they stop eating gluten and they feel so much better. But you're saying that it's not really gluten that's the issue. It's really the process.
Yes, I'm saying that actually it's not the wheat itself that's necessarily the issue. It is the processing of wheat. And by the way, I just want to make it very clear that we're not talking about people with celiac.
No, no, no. Gluten intolerance. I'm with you. I understand.
Yeah. And you know, that approximately 6% of us have some kind of gluten intolerance based on the clinical studies that are seem to be pretty reliable. But about 35% of us think that we need to cut down on gluten because it's affecting us. So it's very disproportionate. And a lot of that has to do with stuff that has nothing to do with really the gluten itself. It has, and even if you are a gluten sensitive, I think you might be, very good odds that it's the processing of wheat, as you were just saying, Nike, that is the real issue. Because when you ferment wheat or any other grain 4 hours or less, which is what industrial bakers do, you really don't have give nature any chance of breaking down the gluten molecules that can create problems for a lot of people. It's not that they can't create problems. It's that the way that industrial foods, processed foods are made in this country does nothing to eliminate the potential hazards or even the discomforts that might be created.
All right, so what should we be eating? When something says that it's whole wheat bread, is that considered whole grain bread, and can you eat it? Because I've heard people say, well, whole wheat bread isn't really necessarily whole grain. So what should we be
eating? Whole wheat bread has to be only 51% whole wheat to qualify for the stamp that's on it that says whole wheat. So the FDA is not doing a lot to make sure that when something is a whole grain and we pick it up and think we're eating whole wheat, that it's actually 100% whole wheat. It has to actually say on the package it's 100% whole wheat. And even if it is, it's going to still have been fermented pretty much the same way if it's packaged bread, which is in an industrial environment, it's going to speed through the whole process that should really take at least three times as long.
Long fermentation process, correct?
Exactly. Okay. Long fermentation really is what sourdough is all about, or sprouting too.
Well, let's talk about sourdough and sprouting, because I think those are, you know, they're key points in your book, and it's very interesting.
They are key points in my book, and they're also things I knew nothing about. I mean, obviously, as a consumer, I always liked sourdough bread, but I never paid much attention to it. Mm-hmm. But what I discovered, to keep this conversation short, and there's a longer version in my book, of course, when you long ferment, what you wind up doing is, among other things, you're delivering all sorts of nutrients that you don't get from short fermentation, and you are breaking down the gluten molecules into small units called peptides, which are small strings of amino acids. They go through your gut wall much more comfortably than large gluten molecules, which can give people problems. And they also go in at a much slower, the sugar that is created, the glucose that's created from starch, goes into your bloodstream at a much slower rate, so you don't get sugar spikes and you don't get the insulin resistance that you often can get from white flour if you're particularly prone to that.
And so when we only have a couple minutes left, but let's talk, so you started making your own bread based on all your research?
I do. In fact, I made it yesterday. My wife and I just had a first piece of it today. I make home-baked sourdough breads, which, by the way, are really not that tricky to do once you get the starter going.
And, well, I think that's the fear for most people. They're afraid of making the starter because it seems...
Yes, well, they could easily go to someplace like King Arthur Flour.
Right, sure.
And get a starter and, or go to their local artisan baker who will often give them some, if they want to do a shortcut. But once you start doing it, you do it over about 24 hours usually. So I break it up into 2 days. But you don't, that's only about a half hour of active working time during that time. You're essentially allowing the whole wheat flour, which I use with a little bit of white flour, but not much, to break down all of the components in the way that really the time that's required, which is long fermentation. And that really is the way to go. It also releases phosphorus and all sorts of other minerals that don't get released in short fermented products.
Well, I have to tell you, I started reading the book and I fell into it as it's a fascinating read. It's a fascinating journey that you took. The name of the book is Grain of Truth, The Real Case For and Against Wheat and Gluten. Stephen Yaffa is the author. I assume we can find it on Amazon and in bookstores all over the place, correct?
Yes, and I do want to mention that I'm going to be doing a reading at Kramer Books in middle of June, on the 17th of June, and I've invited Mark Furstenberg, who's really
perfect, yeah.
The
king of bread.
Everybody, exactly, to join me, because, you know, hearing about things is one thing, but also tasting is really something that people should have an opportunity to do. So he's game. He's going to bring some of his breads, and we're going to make it a tasting reading, which I think is the way to go with this.
Right. I think that sounds like fun.
Okay, terrific. Okay, well, people will be able to find that on Nikki's website,
Absolutely.
The list. Stephen, thanks very much. I'll say hi to Barbie for you.
Thank you. Please do.
All right, take care.
You.
Take care.
That was very interesting.
Absolutely.
All right, and speaking of interesting, Scott Harris is here. He's the founder, along with his wife, am I correct,
yeah,
of Catoctin Creek Distillery. When we first met him, he was all G. Willikers because he had started the first distillery in Loudoun County since before Prohibition, and now he's selling his stuff in Bim Bam Boo, and he's a mogul. You're a mogul.
But I'm still G. Willikers.
And he's still messing with me. Because everybody here got a taste of a drink that he just mixed up, and I got a bucket of it. So let's talk about the growth of Catoctin Creek.
We're just very lucky. We're very happy to be, you know, honored with the Rammies again this year. We're just a small family-run company. We have about 20 employees now.
Gee willikers.
But D.C.'s our home, and so to be, you know, in and among all the restaurant people in D.C., is a huge honor, so we're very happy.
Well, you always, I mean, at the very beginning even, this is probably about 4 years ago,
mm-hmm.
you were emphasizing the fact that it was only organic
yep.
ingredients and all that. Why does that matter?
We are a certified organic company, and we try to do things, this is a challenge, but we try to do things sustainably and profitably. And doing those both at the same time can be quite a challenge.
Together.
Yeah, and so it's a certified organic product, which means we're taking care of the planet as we enjoy the bounty from it. We put in a 44,000 watt solar array on our roof, so we're generating 80% of our electricity from our roof.
Yeah, you'll know Gene Bauer is nodding.
Yeah, I figured.
You're getting a nod from Gene Bauer.
For us here.
That's
but,
it, man.
You know, we want to make nice drinks, and we also feel that the organic also parlays into a more historically accurate spirit and a better tasting spirit. You know, we didn't have Roundup back in the 1800s. And so this will taste like whiskey back in
I think
those
Roundup's
days.
Delicious. I like to squirt it right in. And
like Banaca.
So this is your second nomination for this award.
It is.
You feeling, you know.
Feeling cocky?
Oh, I'm nervous as hell. No, it's a great group. I mean, D.C. Brow and New
Can
Columbia.
Can you say to me on the way in, I'm going to wipe these guys out?
No.
Don't tell them I said so.
Take a little Tonya Harding kneecap action.
Right.
I'm going to kneecap Jonathan.
Yeah, no.
Right.
It's an honor just to be in the room. So.
But as your company has grown, you've added more products,
mm-hmm.
and you're doing more things at the distillery.
We are. We do a lot of events out at the distillery, mm-hmm. Dinners and concerts. We've got some really awesome concerts lined up in our series this year.
When are the concerts? Are they Saturday?
I think my band
Fridays?
Is reuniting.
They're typically on a Friday night. Mm-hmm. We have Howie Day coming out. We've had Pat McGee out a number of times. Mm-hmm. We have a number of people who, you know, people... Who
Did
are
you
younger than me
basket?
Would know. What's that?
Do you come with a picnic basket? I mean, how
no,
does it work?
No, so if you've not been to the distillery, we need to get you guys out there.
I know we
haven't
been.
It's kind of an urban environment.
As soon as the kids go to camp.
Yeah,
yes.
We've got a tasting room. We actually have the concerts right inside the distillery, right among the gleaming copper stills.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, you can come in, have some drinks, and enjoy the show.
Sounds fabulous.
Isn't
cool.
gleaming copper stills a phrase in America the Beautiful?
I think so.
Heard that
it
somewhere.
Should be. We certainly have our history there.
All right, so just tell us quickly what you made today.
So this is a cocktail made by Chad Robinson, our brand ambassador. Wonderful cocktail. Take on the hurricane. And it's called The Devil and His Wife. And it gives a little Virginia take to the hurricane, which we used a local pawpaw. Chad made a pawpaw syrup. Pawpaw is a native fruit of Virginia, a lot like a banana, a little bit like a custard.
Mm-hmm.
And like
yeah,
a banana, it's very fragile. It ripens very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So we made a syrup into it, and we did a house-made grenadine, a little bit of orange, a little bit of lime juice, and then equal parts the Roundstone Rye whiskey and the Mosby Spirit moonshine. Together those with all of this, you'd swear there was rum in the drink, and there's not a drop of rum in it.
It's fabulous. So. And you're going to be pouring this at the Rammies?
And this is our signature for the Rammies. We made this for the Rammies. Yeah, it's
and
fantastic.
And it's strong.
It's yeah. good.
Like a hurricane, it's got to knock
David's
you down.
David's going to be waiting around and not be an inebriated driver
all right,
home.
Well, cheers. We wish
Thank
you the best
you.
Of
cheers.
Luck. Everybody, this is David and Nikki Nellis with Foodie and the Beast.
You almost forgot your last name.
I have no
it
idea
is
who
strong.
I am anymore. We'll be back in just a minute.
You're so annoying.
You're so annoying.
Stop copying me.
Stop copying me.
Mom, tell her to stop copying me.
Mom, tell her to stop talking to me.
Kids will spend 10 minutes copying everything their sibling says.
You're such a doofus.
You're such a doofus.
How about 2 minutes to brush their teeth? Brushing for 2 minutes now can save your child from severe tooth pain later. For fun 2-minute videos to watch while brushing, visit 2min2x.org. 2 minutes, twice a day. I have the time.
Mom!
A message from the Partnership for Healthy Mouths, Healthy Lives, and the Ad Council.
Hey, Mom. Why is the sky blue? Why don't animals talk? Why do dogs have wet noses? Why is an 11 pronounced 1T1?
Kids ask a lot of questions.
Why do I have a belly button?
But you don't have to know every answer.
Why is the ocean salty?
Because you don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent.
Why are there 50 states?
There are thousands of children in foster care who don't need every question answered.
Why is pizza round?
They just need you. For more information on how you can adopt, go to AdoptUSKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt U.S. Kids, and the Ad Council.
This is Mark Amtower. With lower margins, your limited marketing budget has to work harder than ever. LinkedIn is one of the most robust marketing platforms available. With over 350 million members worldwide, 110 million in the U.S., and 3.1 million members within 50 miles of this station, I guarantee your customers and prospects are here. Connect, influence, motivate, create leads. I can show you how. When you want to maximize the return on your LinkedIn presence, email me at mark@federaldirect.net.
In the small town of Elmira, New York, a boy was born into an all-American family. The odds of him achieving his dream in the fashion industry? 1 in 23 million. The odds of having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 68. I am Tommy Hilfiger, and my family is affected by autism. Learn more at autismspeaks.org/signs. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
Hey, we're back on Foodie and the Beast with David and Nikki Nellis. We're talking to all of the nominees.
Almost all. We're missing
almost
one.
You know what? Jump right in. Rammy nominees. And next up is John Usselton, who, just like with the guys from Catoctin Creek, he and his wife Elizabeth Lowe were in here right after you opened the distillery. I think it was like 2 weeks after. And you were talking about your high hopes for just getting some distribution. And now you're everywhere. And I just handled the grand opening of the AC Hotel, the Marriott, out in National Harbor, and you were top of the line there.
They've been Marriott in general, and that location has been a very big supporter, and they've really kind of taken on, you know, Marriott as a company. I think across the nation is really kind of latching on to a lot of these small craft producers. And really want to showcase.
Well, I saw you pull up in that Bentley. Was that? I guess it's going well. Is that right?
I don't know quite like that, but we do have a new still on order, so it's supposed to be here next week.
Same thing.
Next month,
same thing.
So. It's a Bentley of stills.
It is a Bentley of stills, exactly.
So
just give us a little background.
And talk. I want to hear also about George Cassidy, the bootlegger. That you know.
Yes.
Tell us the whole story.
So George Cassidy is the gentleman who Green Hat Gin is named after. He's known as the man in the green hat, and he was a bootlegger to Congress from basically 1920 to 1930. Had an office in the basement.
He's the reason the Depression was brought on, because they were all schnookered? Is that?
Well, I think they brought the Depression on themselves. He was trying to help the Depression. So basically, he had an office in the basement of the Cannon Office Building for 5 years, from 20 to 25. Had a little run-in with Capitol Hill Police, which was when he got his nickname, the man in the green hat. And moved over to the Russell Building and had another office in the basement of Russell for another 5 years.
Unbelievable.
You know, selling to 4/5 of Congress during basically the most of Prohibition. You know, they're passing laws during the day. And
you mean they were hypocrites even back then?
Oh, yeah. Which is one of the reasons we read the story in Garrett Peck's book. We were just like, this is perfect. This is, you know, a story from, you know, back, you know, in Prohibition, you know, and a lot of distilleries like to harken back to that period, and but it's a very DC story, and we wanted to be
a very DC story.
Yeah, we wanted to be a very DC distillery. You know, we're purposely located in DC and looked for space when we opened in DC, and we're very much focused on that. And when you find a story that has, you know, a bootlegger that is on, you know, on the grounds of Congress and selling the 4/5 of Congress, like, how do you pass that up?
How hard was it to open up a distillery in DC?
It wasn't that bad. I mean, really. DC government, as far as they're concerned, as far as the liquor application, that was fine. You know, build out with DCRA, and it's another story. But
okay.
with spirits, the problem is the feds. You know, they you know, the federal application was, you know, basically it's a binder. You know, it's mm-hmm. it's 150 pages. They want to know, you know, everybody you've ever known, everybody that may be an investor in the business, you, mm-hmm. everything that you'd ever want to know, they want to know it. And they want great detail about it.
The, so then why do you think, I mean, you're the first distillery here in over 100 years, right?
Yes, yeah.
So why do you think that is?
Well, I mean, I think there's a number of reasons for it. I mean, you know, and across the country, you had distillers that had already opened.
Mm-hmm. But was it the big guns? Do you think that people, like, now that this craft artisan thing is really happening, you know, just with beer and now with spirits and with, you know, more people are opening wineries and things like that, do you just think it's more accessible now?
I think that's a little bit of it. And mm-hmm. I think you're looking at, you know, in the 70s and 80s, you had the, you know, small wineries exploding. In the, you know, 90s and early 2000s, you had small you know, breweries exploding. Uh-huh. And I think that D.C. was, you know, to a certain extent, there wasn't a lot of people who wanted to open a distillery. And it was a little bit transient of those people that maybe would do those kind of things. Mm-hmm. You come to work for the government for 2 years. You move back to wherever you're from or right. to somewhere else. You can come to school for a couple of years and you leave also. Mm-hmm. But I think in the last few years, which is why we have this category, I think, is,
right.
you know, people are making things here. You know, you've got people making charcuteries. You got people making pickles. You got people making, you know, whiskey and
gelato.
Beer and gelato and all these mm-hmm. kind of things. And I think that you've got people who are staying and are putting roots down in D.C. like, you know, I think that they used to. When we had a lot of breweries,
you're making
and
it sound so exciting. You know,
it's
so,
it is exciting.
It's a really cool
if you're
area.
Not excited by what's happening in D.C., specifically about food and beverages and all these kind of things, then you're not paying attention or you just don't care.
All right, so let's talk. We've got about a minute here. I want to talk about your Rammy nomination because this is your first one, right?
This is our first one.
How's that
very
feel?
Excited.
Will you be wearing a ball gown?
I am. I've awesome. Got a nice sequin outfit.
I've got an umpire waist.
It better not clash with mine. That's all I have to say.
I'll send you some photos.
Okay, good. Okay, good.
Because there are some interesting outfits there. Why not?
Yeah, you know, I think we'll probably be fairly traditional. We're bringing the wives and you
what
know,
did you pour?
We're having what's that?
What'd you pour?
This is our spring summer seasonal.
Okay.
So, you know, I thought you know this is the time of year we love.
It smells
this,
delicious.
This gin was made for tall drinks, gin and tonics, and Ricky's. You know, the DC it's official cocktail is the Ricky.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the idea behind this. A little cherry blossoms in it. It's clover blossoms.
It's very
roses.
A lot of floral.
A lot of citrus. It makes a really nice Ricky and a good gin and tonic and a number of other kind of things. So, so we're very excited. We've got some other products that are coming out soon. Things are happening.
All right, so
well,
we're going to see you
you'll
there.
You'll let us know when those
we definitely
new things
will.
Are happening.
June 7th. Let's go back to Dave Moran to wrap up and talk about the Rammies. So, how did you become
the chair,
the grand poobah of the gala?
I guess if you stick around long enough.
No, you probably raised your arm to scratch.
Exactly.
Your head.
well, I went for many years as an attendee, and I was actually an award winner myself years back. Mm-hmm. And I just saw the industry changing, and I wanted to be part of it. And I think like we sit around a day like today with these folks, and not only we hear like. It's really translating to sales as well. Consumers want all these products.
I know.
And being part of it is really just an exciting thing. So,
well, as what you do with Clyde's, I mean, and you guys are so on the forefront of working with local farms.
Absolutely.
And working with local products. I mean, it's such a natural, don't you think?
Absolutely. And, you know, John Latham, our founder, told us the story where he and Tom Meyer were driving down to the Eastern Shore one day and they found these great cantaloupes. And everything was happening right there. And they went back to their own restaurant and saw that we were buying cantaloupe from
like California.
California, Mexico.
Right, right.
And that really got them going on it. And it's where we are today. And
right.
Yeah, so.
And do you think, and because Clyde's is so big, you know, I think sometimes we think of these smaller products as being in smaller restaurants. But you guys have so many properties and they're large properties. Are you able to work with these smaller products and be able to... Explain it to the
absolutely
and get the distribution, but also explain it to the consumer.
Well, that's that's hard to do, but we work really hard on the training part of that.
Mm-hmm.
We certainly need to talk to the suppliers to make sure you can supply us. You know,
sure.
You don't want to bring something in and not be able to. I think a great example is the DC Brow folks. You know, we partnered with them very early on. They are now the second leading beer seller in all the Clyde's Group.
That's amazing.
I mean, we love it. They love
don't
it.
Don't tell Dave Coleman. That's
well,
great.
I love Dave's beers too. So, but again, I think this what we're doing this morning. It's this is where this
Dave's at home going Brandon.
This is where DC's come. Again, for those of us who have been in town for
20 years or so.
Right.
I mean, this town was a couple of fine, expensive French restaurants and some bars. And now...
Steakhouses.
And look what it is now. It is a... It's the place to be. And it's not lost that chefs and everyone from around the country is coming here to open restaurants.
Well, we got 1 minute. I want to talk about the Duke Ziebert Award. I don't know if you can recall all the nominees there. The first... The Duke Ziebert Award is given to the person who's identified as having done the most during that past year to support and develop and raise up the whole restaurant industry. I think Bob Pincus was the first winner. Mm-hmm. I mean, who's up for it? Do you know? Can you remember the nominees? Because that's such a great award.
Yeah. Over the years, it's been, you know, Jean-Louis was a winner. Stuart Davidson, again, the founder of Clyde's, was.
Right.
And we've done a couple of politicians. This year, it's Herb Miller.
Right.
You know, Herb has developed some of the biggest projects that have revitalized.
For those of you that don't know, Herb Miller equals the mills, Potomac Mills and all the other mills all over the country.
Yeah. And for he was, you know, a big part of bringing Gallery Place development, which really sort of revitalized downtown D.C.
and Quarter.
And exactly.
It was really the kickoff to everything that grew out of it. 14th Street, you know, I think they thought that if Penn Quarter could be a financial success, then these other opportunities, like
Absolutely.
Look at Navy Yards, I mean,
same thing.
So.
And he's, you know, when we actually presented him with the award or the announcement, his next project is to sort of take it across the Anacostia and start revitalizing that part of D.C.
Yeah,
and,
that's
great.
He'd be worth talking to just on that alone.
All right, so unfortunately, we've got to move along. Rammies.org is the website to go to. You can still get tickets?
Sold out, my friend.
All right, don't bother. But go there anyways.
We're going.
Very quickly, I want to thank the folks that sponsor and support the show, the people at Georgetown Bagelry, our friends at ProFish, John Rohrpaugh, the Mandarin Oriental Washington, the Hyatt Regency Chesapeake Bay, the American Land Board, and Celebrity Cruises, a new one.
Yes, they are.
Cooly coolo, man.
Exciting.
Let's go cruising.
All right.
That's it. That's all I got.
I know. Well, it was a terrific show. We want to thank all of our guests for joining us today. A big round of applause for everybody.
Yeah.
Cheers.
Really super. Cheers. Super interesting.
What's next week?
You know what? I don't have what's up for next week. So,
well, we'll be here.
We'll be here, and so will other really fascinating people.
And I'll be eating
people.
A vegan diet just to give it a shot.
Actually, I do know one of our guests who is coming in next week. So, you know, marijuana is getting legalized sort of in
D.C. It is?
But edibles, as they are called. No, you won't be smoking in studio.
Oh, sorry.
Edibles, as they are called, edible marijuana-based products. We are going to have one of the founders of a local organization who will be selling.
It'll be great. They'll be sold at Highs.
Okay.
Thank you.
Everybody, thank you so much for joining us today. And please have a delicious week.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTLP FM HD2 Braddock Heights Frederick, the Washington, D.C. home of Navy Athletics.